All right, and welcome to episode 2 of Fictherpology. And this time we have 4 expert panelists introducing our new one, Aaris, who will be joining us, I hope, long term, but at least for now in this episode. So, Aaris, would you like to introduce yourself?
I would love to introduce myself. I am joining you guys long term because this is awesome. Yay. I just, you know, I listened to your previous podcast, so I'll do something similar for my introduction. I wasn't really Fannish until I got to college, which was around 2002. Although I could identify as a fan, I was pretty hardcore into Lord of the Rings in high school, and did actually a lot of academic work. I worked with a professor at a college when I was in high school on Lord of the Rings, but it never translated to the online community that I primarily identify with in fandom. Once I got into college, though, it was just like, it was all over for me. I was in Lord of the Rings, and then I did a lot of fanish behavior in Smallville. And I kind of jumped onto that sort of, I don't want to call it mainstream fandom, but there was a significant amount of fan in Smallville fandom. And I got sort of introduced to fandom proper through my interactions with the Smallville people. And then I sort of kept going. Supernatural, Merlin, Stargate Atlantis, and Battlestar Galactica. Actually, recently, I'm primarily in Teen Wolf, which is the most gif-able fandom ever. And I'm pretty heavily invested, actually, in hockey RPF. So if we ever want to talk RPF or any of that stuff, I am 100% interested in discussing my weird obsession with reading fan fiction about mostly Canadians having awkward feelings about each other and playing hockey.
Yay, Canadians!
Go Canada!
It's like Canada. My mind. We are a 50% Canadian podcast here.
Exactly. 50%
true. Back
bacon. Yeah. It's an international podcast, man.
It's true. And I guess my interest in this podcast is not just only to discuss sort of fan fiction and fandom, but I'm interested in the specific processes that go on, especially within this idea of writing fan fiction or creating fan publications. So Neri, I'm particularly interested in your work with AO3, and maybe we could sort of wrangle that into a into a sort of discussion. A little bit later.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
It would. So that's me, and I would like to just finally point out that this is not my real voice. I am bravely soldiering through a sore throat, but this is not what I actually sound like. My voice is way better than this. So to reiterate, this is not my real voice, which may actually be a good jumping off quote to start our discussion of Henry Jenkins's Textual Poachers, Television Fans, and Participatory Culture. What do you guys think?
Yes. It's a good quote.
So, Aaris is the one who read this first out of all of us way back in the day.
Yeah, way back in the day.
Do you want to introduce it at all for the people who are not familiar with the text?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say what I told Elanya when I recommended this, which is that it's kind of one of the most basic academic texts about fandom, or what he calls participatory culture, which is actually something that I really like, because it kind of goes beyond what most people traditionally associate with fandom. I read it probably in 2003 or 2004, and I actually read it for a class. I was taking a class in college on recording, and the way that recording things sort of interacts with the things that you're actually recording. And I did a whole... No, I mean, it was kind of like one of these faffy bit, like, not feelings, but sort of like very, very postmodern discussion courses that I sort of lucked into. I didn't really know the sort of class I was taking until I walked in on the first day and I was like, actually, this is really awesome. But I did mine on LiveJournal. I did a original research on LiveJournal. And I used this because I used the medium of Live Journal in order to discuss how fans interacted. And what I really liked about this text, I found fascinating, was that it was published in 1992. So it's an entire discussion of fandom that really doesn't talk about the internet. Which, because the internet was like my gateway into fandom, like I could not conceive of fandom without the internet. So on some way, it was like learning my own history.
Yeah.
You know, all these people who were like, yes, remember when it was just zines and cons? And I was like, what? Yeah. what's a zine? Right? So reading this, I was like, oh my God, this is so weird. Because, you know, it's not, you know, some of the processes here, it seems remarkably slow, some of this. You know, you would write a story and then send it off, and then you would get feedback like the next con or the next zine publication. And that would just be like, now you get feedback, like, right away. Someone gives you kudos on AO3. You're like, yes, kudos.
Yeah, there's sort of an instantaneous craving for feedback now that you expect it and you're disappointed if you don't get it. And so it's...
Well, that's the internet, though. That's the internet.
Yeah.
It's just faster turnaround time. Yeah. I mean, I was really struck by, I get what you're saying about it being this really foreign, landscape to someone who came into fandom after the internet. But on the other hand, I was really struck by how recognizable a lot of the conventions and things, conventions like genre conventions, not like cons, that he talks about still are in terms of things that I see, you know, all the time when I'm reading or writing fic, that hasn't really changed that much in some ways.
Yeah, like the sorts of things that people write about, the kinds of issues that they engage with and so forth are all still the same.
Absolutely. Right. And even I would say that the mundane cultural perception of fandom has remarkably shifted, I would say. There's still this distrust that he writes about in the first couple of chapters that I think is interesting having seen it laid out the way he does, and then apply it to sort of the responses that I get, not just personal responses, but when I see fan fiction being presented in the media.
Right.
It's not foreign to people, but it's still considered very weird and like only something a real weirdo would do.
Right. So I think this actually makes a very good jumping off point to get into maybe outlining some of his arguments and what exactly Jenkins is trying to do with this text. Which, sort of Zaharis has sort of already started to talk about. What he was trying to do was basically, there's a quote from from his conclusion. So, where he's talking about how.
What page?
It's, I have the ebook version. I read it online. but it's on page 183. So, it's the first page of the conclusion, is what it is. And so. He says, if fans are often represented as antisocial, simple-minded, and obsessive, I wanted to show the complexity and diversity of fandom as a subcultural community, which I think is a really good sum up of what he was trying to do with this book, which is basically to give people a presentation of fandom, you know, what it is, how people in fandom engage with texts in a way that at least... wasn't really recognized in cultural studies and media studies, which is where he was working, where they were seeing people receiving culture very passively.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wanted to basically acknowledge the interactive aspect of fandom and how it is participatory culture, as Aeris was saying previously, and to get that idea that, you know, it isn't just passive, that there's this reactive, active phase, and not to necessarily... see fan culture as being an other, as being a weird extreme of either super passivity where we just accept everything that the canon gives us, but where we interact and create our own material as well. And, you know, we criticize and react with that material on a number of different levels, but also not to present fan culture as being some sort of other weird extreme where, but basically to take into consideration that media consumption in general can encompass both of these kinds of reactions of passivity and activity.
Yeah, because I think at the time he was writing, the main sort of popular culture image of the fan was the Trekkie, and I think he's in some ways trying to broaden that picture and counteract the way it's presented in, like, he talks about that Saturday Night Live skit, the sort of famous one where
right.
Get a life,
yeah, get the a Get life. A Life one,
William Shatner. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and he talks about that one explicitly. Like, he uses that example specifically.
Yeah.
And he unpacks it. I mean, I like what he does where he talks about how we present this figure of the fan as almost a, this is what you don't want your children to turn into. And he unpacks every single aspect of it that sort of, not say repulses people, but that people find strange. I mean, he talks about the infantilization, the feminization, this obsessiveness. Every sort of facet that we look at the fan and as a society, if society looks at the fan figure and sees as basically a deluded, exploitable
pawn.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
When, I mean, I remember going into fandom and I remember someone once coming up to me and telling me how... she didn't use the word inspiring, but she was like, she admired how open I was about being a fan. And I had no idea I was being open about being a fan. I was just like, yes, I just talk about what I do. And what I do is I write stuff about Clark and Lex. That's what I do. So why should I not talk about it? And she was just like, you know, you're really open about that. And that's amazing. And I had no idea that there was this stereotype there. It was just interesting.
Yeah, well, people look at you funny if you admit it.
Yeah, they look at you funny, but for me, it's all about agency. And, you know, he makes the point in here that you, a lot of Fen are actually very well educated, either self-educated or they've gone through a lot of schooling.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very critical thinkers. And they're willing to sort of go to bat for... maybe something that doesn't have the cultural authority that certain texts may encompass or certain readings of certain texts may have. And to me, that's brave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I like that he says you mentioned obsessive, that's one of the stereotypes about fans, but he kind of shows that people do spend a lot of time with the material, but it's not obsessive in necessarily an unhealthy way. It's they're analyzing the material so that they can recreate it and they can think about it and analyze it and not just accept what they're telling us. They're thinking and not obsessing. And I think that was an interesting way to kind of reframe that characteristic of a fan.
Yeah, that fan engagement is really both critical and creative.
Yeah, and he also talks about that the tension or the distance between the, you know, you love the thing, but you can be critical of it at the same time.
Right.
Yes. And sort of maintaining that balance. You know, obviously, it doesn't always work. I mean, you know, if you tip too far towards the critical side, you may just lose the love for the fandom that you had. But
right.
You know, that can always happen. Like, the example he uses is Beauty and the Beast, but I'm sure we can all think of ones from our own experience.
Oh, are you, like, I actually, and it actually, to me, is some of the things that produce some of the best fan fiction. I always find it interesting how shows that are really actually well-constructed, well-written, well-acted, really fantastic shows, you might think of, like, The Wire.
Mm-hmm.
People don't really write The Wire fan fiction.
Right.
Yeah, it's always in Yuletide because it's so small.
Like, yeah.
Yes.
But Stargate Atlantis, which is not a very good show, honestly. Like, you watch it, you're like, there's a lot of, like, weird stuff going on there. Some of the best fan fiction ever was written about Stargate Atlantis, dealing with the very issues that people saw in the show. The whole, you know, the gender issues, the colonialism issues, like, the sexuality issues.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
I just find that very interesting.
Yeah, one of the things that Jenkins says, again, in his conclusion, and I promise I did read more than just the conclusion. I just read that only about 2 hours before this podcast, so it's more fresh in my mind. But one of the things he says is that in terms of fan culture, it's not necessarily that the texts that fans are engaging with are particularly empowering, but that their reaction and their ability to create and jump off, as Aeris was saying, create new material from that, like that experience itself is empowering.
Right. And it seems like a lot of the fandoms that get chosen are ones that have a lot of potential that doesn't necessarily get realized.
Right.
Or else there's a world that, like with Star Trek, the world that they create is just so huge that there's a lot of room to play in it. But there's other ones that get chosen because the characters are really interesting, and then people are disappointed with what the writers do with it, and so they want to take over and make their own versions right. of what these characters do.
One of the things I thought was really interesting too in his chapter 6, Welcome to Bisexuality, Captain Kirk, / the fan writing community.
I will say that when I got this book, this was the very first chapter I read.
Just jump right to the chase.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
And I mean, he talks about it some too in chapter 4, It's Not a Fairy Tale Anymore, Gender, Genre, and Beauty and the Beast. But basically, with the kinds of stories that fans write about the characters that they're interested in are not the kinds of things that are presented on the screen. Mm-hmm. So he talks in chapter 4 about how like television doesn't want to show you a completed romance. Like it wants to keep those what in fandom is referred to as UST, the unresolved sexual tensions, ongoing. Right. Like, they don't want to get to the point where you have a solid relationship to work with because they want to keep that drawn out. Whereas
right, which is part of the business model of television, and you can't really get away from
yes.
it.
Yes, right. Right. And I mean, I think if we want to go back to 80s shows, like Moonlighting,
mm-hmm.
yes.
apparently, you know, when they resolved that relationship, everyone was like, oh, now this show sucks.
Yes. Right.
And yeah. I think television has been like scared off permanently by these examples, you know, that they can point to of shows where the audience just dropped off after the main couple finally got together, kind of thing.
Right.
Right. And what fans, though, we want to see that kind of relationship. We want to give it more depth. And mm-hmm. so that's a lot of the things that he was talking about people writing, like, you know, how they deal with, you know, relationships in that regard, and how in Beauty and the Beast, there was a lot of this interest in that primary relationship between Catherine and Vincent, who were the two main characters of that show way back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being young and really wanting to stay up and watch that show, but not being allowed to, or
aww.
Like everybody making fun of me for thinking it was interesting. Oh, well.
It's all right. I used to want to watch Beastmaster.
That's fair.
But Beastmaster was awesome.
But
yeah, it was okay.
Yeah.
But there was a shirtless guy on it,
right.
which as a teenager
exactly.
I found extremely interesting.
Yep.
That's fair. But then anyway, in chapter 6 he talks about, you know, how people or how fans again have, you know, look at slash relationships, and in one of the kinds of slash relationships, they're basically looking or in general. I think he's kind of making an argument for in general for how people again, I say people, I mean fans specifically. They're looking at the sort of the homosocial relationships and then sort of expanding
yes.
those into the homosexual relationships so that people have a really strong relationship on screen. They want to see that expanded into other areas of their life. And what mm-hmm. it made me think of was like if you combine those two things where you get those really strong complementary relationships between men on screen that you don't get between men and women. And I think that is
yes.
part of the reason. I mean, and he talks about that a little bit about why people see slash on the
mm-hmm.
screen, why that's so easy to read into those relationships, because we see that kind of connection between people, between male characters, but we don't necessarily get that strong stuff
and
between
and
men
the
and egalitarian.
I mean, he
nature.
Talks about the egalitarian relationship.
Yes,
yeah.
And it's
exactly.
given it's given space to develop, right? You don't have the girlfriend of the week syndrome,
right?
Like you see all the time at Starsky and Hutch, right?
Yeah.
I love her. Next week she's gone.
She's dead,
right?
Or something,
or she's undercover or whatever. Like these relationships satisfy in a way that the sort of the traditional romance does not. Because they are ongoing, because there's lots of depth to them, because there's, you know, backstory that can be, you know, sort of plunged, plundered, explored. I'm veering into odd verbs. But because there's backstory, because they're, you know, thinking about the Kirk and Spock as sort of one of the archetypal slash relationships, Right. You know, it is this very odd couple, right? You can do some sort of like structuralist analysis of it. But something I read once that I found really interesting was that women actually, when they look at Kirk and Spock, they identify a lot of the time with Spock, because a lot of women who sort of watched Star Trek and are really identified with the characters there are a little more cerebral. Mm. And so it was interesting to see this sort of interplay between a very emotional sort of, say, physicality and instinctive character like Kirk, and then the logical, more cerebral character like Spock. And if you sort of get away from gender, then it becomes an interesting way to look at how personalities interact.
Right.
And then if you're like, if that's something that interests you, then actually developing a sexual relationship becomes not inevitable, but certainly not the weird avenue that a lot of people see fan fiction as.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I mean, that's only one of the ways that, I mean, he talks about a lot of different things that people write Slash for, but that was the one that I sympathized with the most, that like this is one of the ways, you know, this is what attracts me to that kind of relationship as well, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I like the equality issue where he talked about that mm-hmm. there's a different kind of power dynamic going on between two men than you get between two women. And I often feel like it's nice to have that out of the male-female power struggle is gone when you read Slash, and it just kind of makes things easier. I mean, there's other issues, especially if you want to be realistic and include actual real-world issues of homophobia, but you have a different type of interaction, and yeah, you get sort of equality in the bedroom.
Yes.
Which you don't get mm-hmm. as much.
Yeah, I thought he made an interesting point when he talked about how in, for instance, science fiction settings where the writers are presuming a minimal or minimized degree of homophobia,
right.
where they'll then put up sort of other obstacles towards the characters mm-hmm. getting together, like class differences or like rank differences or whatever,
right.
That can allow them to have some kind of obstacle to overcome without it being about, oh my God, the gay.
Right. Yeah.
Yes. Well, and another thing that he points out that I really do like is how a lot of the times the readings of some of the characters, we assume when a man walks on screen that he's straight.
Yeah.
It's what we're programmed to think. Mm-hmm. So this sort of heterosexist understanding, when you take that away, all of a sudden this total, you know, it's almost like it opens up a bunch of things. He talks about this a lot, which he's one of the first people I've ever read which talked about this. Is how we assume that, okay, there's a woman on screen, and unless she explicitly presents as a lesbian, right, unless mm-hmm. she's got, like, a trucker hat and flannel, whatever the stereotype is,
right,
then we're going to assume that she wants to have sex with men. And when you sort of put the Slash goggles on or take the heterosexist goggles off, then a woman walks on screen, and you're like, this deep relationship that she has with her best friend, you know, what if it's something more? Or the cop who's working with, you know, one of the fandoms that I read in right now is Rizzolian Isles. And one of the things I love about that is how they portray a really deep female friendship on screen, and I can read it as a really deep platonic female friendship. But these are two characters who share each other's bed, who go to each other first in order to solve any problem, and who complement each other perfectly in terms of their approach to problem solving. And you watch it and you automatically think, like, huh,
yeah.
These two characters, like, what are the obstacles towards them being a couple? And do they have to hide it because they're in police work and then that would sort of make people would make fun of them? Are there, you know, one of the characters is from a slightly lower class background than the other? You know, is there a certain sort of, you know, stigma that she's not willing to face about herself? So once you stop viewing things as assuming that just because she's a woman, she's going to be attracted to a man, it's like this almost texture that comes out that's really quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things that in general, you know, Jenkins is talking about and that I've found is that in fan fiction, you do have that wider range of possibilities to explore than what you can necessarily get from mainstream media.
Right.
Whether it's I want to, you know, read stories about men having sex with men, or whether it's like I want to look at the deep emotional trauma that this person has experienced, or, you know, sort of really delve into their background, or you just have that option to go places where, you know, the canon doesn't go. Mm-hmm.
Or even right. pick up some minor character that doesn't really get used much.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Yeah. Hello.
Welcome to me. Yeah, we don't know anyone who does that.
No.
Actually, I think this would be a good time, since we're over here, to turn to his discussions of genres.
Right.
In chapter 5, I believe it
yes.
is. Yes. Where he talks about the different sort of the various, I don't know if I like the word genre, but the sort of
right.
categories that he says 10 ways to rewrite a television show.
Right.
In my book it's page 162, but that's right. I have the 1992 printing.
That's what I have too.
So.
Yep, me too.
Yeah, sort of the middle of chapter 5.
And I think it would be interesting to kind of go around and talk about everyone pick one and talk about why you like it or sort of experiences that you've had with it to just give a little bit of structure. And let's start with Alanya.
No, don't start with me.
I know which one.
Don't start with me right now because I'm experiencing technical difficulties.
Oh.
With my ebook version. It's not letting me into my actual chapter. So somebody else go first. I'll be with you in a second.
All right. Neri, do you want to go?
Sure. Although I'll try not to talk about whatever Lanny's going to talk about.
Remind me what I should be talking about.
You're going to talk about the whole, like, tiny characters.
Oh, yes, I am. Characters. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's refocalization is the one that you're going to talk about.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I will not talk about refocalization.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to go straight to eroticization.
Awesome.
Because that's,
I love you. You're my favorite.
You know, because that's my thing. And, I mean, that is often the thing that I want to explore when I'm writing or when I'm reading fan fiction, is I'm like, I want to see these people having sex. I mean, not necessarily purely out of, you know, self-gratification, because I think it's an interesting way to explore elements of their character that don't necessarily, you know, make it on screen or on the page in the original source. And I think that, you know, he talks a bit about the playful side of, like, writers trying to combine the craziest kind of combinations of pairings of characters that they can think of, which I certainly can appreciate and have found amusing and entertaining in the past in things like that.
I've definitely written based on a dare. Like, people are like,
yeah.
You can't do that. And I'm like, ha ha, watch me.
Yeah, yes, definitely, can. Yeah. I have also, you know, had that kind of thing where it's like, oh, that could... Oh, no, wait, I could make that work. Okay.
Awesome.
Yeah, so that was the one I'll pick to talk about. I think I'm good, if anybody else wants to...
I'm back! I can talk now all about right. refocalization.
Can I ask Neri a question?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes.
So what do you think about his last paragraph, and when he says, fans read these stories not so much to relive their own experiences of the television episodes as to explore the range of different uses writers can make of the same materials, to see how familiar stories will be retold and what new elements will be introduced. Blah, blah, blah. The cumulative effect of reading many such stories is to alter one's perception of the series. That's something I've found is true in myself. Have you ever found that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I certainly have... I mean, I think that's the whole concept of fanon, right? Like, you read things or you come up with ideas and you're like, that's true now. I'm just going to assume that that's true. You know, whenever I'm watching this show or, you know, reading this book or whatever, I'm going to have that in the back of my mind as something that, you know, happened to this character once, or, you know, something that this character, he really has, you know, an interest in this other character. And I'm never going to be able to unsee that now.
Headcanon.
Yeah, headcanon, fanon, whatever you want to call it. I mean, it really can alter your interpretation of the original source material for sure.
Yeah, I agree.
Cool.
All right, does somebody else have a
yes, a I can. I'll go back again with refocalization.
Refocalization number 3.
Refocalization number 3. This is something that I tend to do a lot, is that I get obsessed with minor characters. So refocalization is basically refocusing go figure, on characters who don't necessarily get a lot of major screen time. So, you know, trying to look at people from around the edges. And so my best example of this, is when I got sucked in, like after the new Star Trek movie, Star Trek Reboot, Star Trek 11, whatever you want to call it, came out. I got sucked in to being fascinated with the Romulans. And this is a long-standing fascination of mine that goes way back to when I was little and was watching or the original series with my mother, and then reading Diane Duane's Rihansu books, and then being fascinated with the Romulans again when they were reintroduced in the Next Generation series. And so I was like, oh, yay, the Romulans! And so, you know, I want to know what's going on with these sort of background character stories, you know, what's going on there. And so this is a little bit of refocalization, because not only looking at, you know, the Romulans, but like looking at who are the rest of the crew who don't even get names for the most part,
right,
in that text. So, and you know, a lot of the times that's where my interests lie. And who are these people who are making things work behind the scenes? You know, what is their perspective on what's going on with these major characters? How do they interact with them? And so there are some canons that really give you a lot of opportunities that, you know, give you lots of really good background characters to work with, and then others where, you know, you can make up so much stuff. It's very liberating in that sense, because you don't have...
It's almost original fiction at that point.
It is. And I mean, I will be honest, a lot of my engagement with fandom stuff tends to be in that way, whereas I like to do world building, and I like to create things that are more original inside of that context than necessarily just playing with established characters and established relationships, even if it's, you know, recontextualizing established characters and established relationships into something else. I still tend to prefer to make things up out of more of a whole cloth in the context of a broader fandom universe. So that's why refocalization, I think everyone was reading this and was like, oh yes, that's what Alanya does.
That's what Alanya does. Fair enough.
All right. Somebody else. Next.
Well, I can go. I have kind of two. Like, one, he has one that's called Emotional Intensification.
Oh, yeah.
Which,
yes.
That was also on my list.
He includes the hurt comfort genre in there, and I'm a sucker for that genre, and I do tend to kind of write it. But I do try to keep it, like, I read some that are just so over the top with the emotions that, like, it jumps the shark for me, and I'm just like, no, I can't even go there. So I tend to try to keep it, like, emotionally intense, but yet realistic at the same time, which is kind of an interesting balance to try to strike. And so that I ends up in my writing a lot. And then there's another one called Genre Shift. Number five, I think, Genre Shifting, which I've never really successfully written myself, but I love to read them because I just find it very playful when you take all these characters and then you stick them in a different setting. Or I read, like, there was a steampunk NCIS one that was hilarious, where they, like, you know, it's sort of almost Sherlock Holmesian, except it's Gibbs and Tony instead of Watson and Holmes. And so and there was a steam-powered clock that was absolutely awesome.
I remember that.
It was really fun. And then there was also I've been reading a bunch of Bonanza fanfiction lately. Don't judge me. And there was one.
Excuse me. Hockey RPF. I'm at the bottom of the barrel,
oh,
people.
No. So anyway, that one they like rewrote to follow the plot of Pride and Prejudice, and so that was also kind of hilarious to try to set like Pride and Prejudice in the Old West, and so that kind of thing I enjoy reading, especially when someone does it really well, because they can take the characters and the setting and do something completely different with it. And sometimes, I guess, especially if you've been reading a lot of standard fanfic and you're kind of sick of it, it's a nice breath of fresh air to have someone like just kind of go crazy and make something a genre that it didn't start out to be. So those are my kind of two favorites on that list.
Cool.
If I can just add to that, I think one of the things that can work really well in an AU like that is where it feels like a giant in-joke, where you're like spotting all the little things that they've managed to translate into, you know, the other setting, and you're like, oh, that's awesome, you know, that, you know, that works so well when you change it from, you know, that to that or whatever.
Right.
Well, actually, and the thing I think that you're picking up on is something that producers of television shows have also started picking up on. So, you know, you think of like the news radio episode where they were on the Titanic, like the space Titanic or something. Right. They did one in space and one in Titanic. It was just a sitcom about a radio show.
Right.
Right.
Behind the scenes.
But they had these like weird sort of one that they set in space and one that they set on the Titanic. And I think television producers and television writers themselves love this. They love doing this. You're exactly yeah. right. It's really playful. Supernatural did one where they actually jumped a whole bunch of genres. Like, there was the multi-camera sitcom they did, and then a Japanese game show, and then they put the Sam and Dean in essentially Grey's Anatomy. It was amazing. I really, really liked it.
Then there's all the holodeck episodes in Star Trek, too, where they wrote in this way, where they can set them in different periods and different contexts, and they sort of have sort of a more meta relationship with it, because it really is the same characters, and they know that it's, you know, a fiction within the show. So you've got that interesting...
Except when it's not. Dun-dun-dun.
Yes.
Or when they do a musical episode.
Musical like episode. Every single time.
Yeah. Right.
Like the Xena musical episode and the Buffy. All fantastic. And very meta.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, but then, see, he has a thing called character dislocation, which I think is basically the real AU
right.
Category, yeah. which is his list of number 7. And so I'm not quite sure. There's kind of a fuzzy line, I think, between the genre shifting and the character dislocation.
Well, I think...
I have to say that when he's like... So I've never read any professionals fan fiction, but when he was like, Ankar's Wine Dark Nexus features Bodhi as an Egyptian and Doyle as a citizen of Atlantis.
Right.
Who are kidnapped and sent to Crete to become bull dancers.
Yes.
Can we find that? I would like to read that.
I thought of you when I was reading that.
Right. It's true. I would read that too, knowing like zero about the characters. I'm like, that sounds pretty awesome.
Well, I think the difference between genre shifting and character dislocation is that if you're just shifting genres, you can keep the same relationships between people.
Yes.
Right.
So, like, if you're, you know, instead of having things set on the Enterprise, you're having something set in like the War of 1812 on a like naval brig or whatever, right? You can still have those same kinds of relationships between people, and so the characters can interact in the same way. Whereas if you're taking characters who I'm not even sure what the professionals are about, but if you're completely recontextualizing,
I think they're spies.
Yeah, cops or spies or whatever. Well, in that that's a huge shift. You know, you don't necessarily have the same background people or their harder to work in, their working relationships are going to be like different. Like, you still have the same personalities to work with, but there's a lot more recontextualization, I think, going on.
I think my understanding of what he meant by character dislocation is things like, you know, so-and-so is secretly an angel, or like that kind of story where it's like this person is some totally different thing, you know, like when he has an example where, you know, someone's an elf or whatever.
He says an even more radical manipulation of generic boundaries. So Bruin are removed from their original situation and given alternative names and identities. So it's kind of like, you know, if you want to think about genre shifting as being maybe, you know, a little bit away from the thing, and then maybe crossovers are a little bit more, and then finally character dislocation. It's like, we know they're the same because we're reading a Bodhi Doyle fan fiction,
right?
But they're not the same.
Yeah, and they you can picture the same actor, and you can maybe give them some similar personality traits, but then kind of everything else is different, I think.
Yeah, this is that's sort of interesting to me because like I do write original fiction, and as I was saying before, a lot of the times when I'm playing in fandom, I do tend to write more about people and situations and like, for example, when I got into the Inception fandom, I was like, everyone's like, let's all write about all these characters. And I'm like, no, let's write about this fascinating concept that we can go into dreams and like mess with people's heads. Let's play with that.
Yeah.
So like, that's the sort of stuff that interests me. But I find that a lot of other, like, you get characterization as shorthand. Like, I can say, you know, this is a Bodhi Doyle fic, like Neri was saying. And people will know, like, they're bringing a lot as readers, as people who are experienced with that canon.
Yes.
They're bringing a lot to that page already. But
or
you don't
even
have to. But you, like, your readers are bringing something to that text already that will help them interpret it in that particular context that you don't need to establish. I mean, because it's shared.
And that they wouldn't bring to it if you said, I'm writing a story about, you know,
two guys.
Cretan bull dancers. They're like, who?
Yes, exactly. And they probably wouldn't want to read that, but...
Oh, I would read that, but...
I would read that, too. I'd write that, please.
But that's fair. I can see that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it would have, you know, you've got this audience who are receptive and who have this,
and who have all that background knowledge that they can bring to bear on what they're reading.
Yeah, and then they can see, you know, like Neri, you were pointing out, you like watching where the similarities between the original text and then whatever fan fiction pops up. Then when you have this character dislocation, you can be like, okay, what are the signifiers? Like, we know this is Bodhi and Doyle, but what are the signifiers that we're seeing here? You know, is the hair the same? Is a certain catchphrase there, but maybe rendered, you know, to be appropriate to the, you know, the late Bronze Age?
Yes.
All right. So, Aris, did you want to pick one from the list?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm definitely on the eroticism train. Mm. But
if you have to pick something,
it's a good train.
It's a great train. It's the best train.
It goes down a lot of tunnels.
It does. And back out again, and back in again.
Yes.
Is it more of a ship than a train? It could be a ship going into a tunnel.
It could be a train. You know, it takes a lot of force. It is both the tunnel and the train.
And the train.
Yes.
But something that I don't write because I'm often intimidated by it, but I love to read is what he puts in at number two, expanding the series timeline. Mm. And I love it when that sort of thing happens. I mean, a lot of the time I see fan fiction as filling holes within the, but adding as an addition to the text. I mean, there's right. the text or the sort of or text, let's think of it as, but these additions to it, and taking, you know, from the end of a season, I always like it when a television show ends or a season ends, and people take, given the nature of how people structure television shows, they all often end it on a cliffhanger or, you know, one thing will be resolved, but then another question, big question will be answered.
Right.
Sorry, questioned. And I love it when people put forward, often in very long fic, sort of their interpretation of what just happened. Actually, the fic that I'm going to wreck at the end of this falls into this category. I just love how people sort of swoop in and take charge of the narrative. And oftentimes I find that, say I've, you know, finished a season and then I read fan fiction based on that season, people will pick up on themes or concepts that are then continued by the writers in the next season, and oftentimes the fan will do it better.
Yes.
Like, this happened all the time in Stargate Atlantis. I'd be reading this fan fiction, I'd be like, yes, you are getting it 100%. And then the next season it would just be the same old, same old. And I just watch it be like, but she did it better. Seriously, guys, you should hire her.
Hire that writer.
She did it. Or even better is when you read something and then you read later stuff and you're like, oh my god, that person picked up on something that I didn't even notice that is actually super important.
Yeah.
And it's just I find it to be a really fascinating way to see how people internalize and manipulate the information that is given to us through television shows or through books or through movies. It's like taking a trip through someone's brain, and I love it because it like, to me, what fan fiction does, and what I think Jenkins talks a little bit about in his, maybe his second chapter or something, is how in fan fiction you're really blurring the line between consumer and producer.
Yes,
right.
You know, in capitalism, there's this very much like people produce things and then you consume it, and that's the way it goes. But the truth is that that's a very flat understanding of A, how the economy works, and B, especially when you get to the creative side of things. Mm-hmm. And to me, fan fiction is very natural in that way, because someone creates something and gives it to you, you don't just consume it. You interpret it and you create something in return.
Right. Yes. Well, and I think also the expanding the timeline thing is helpful for when you just want to spend more time with these characters, because you only get so many episodes of the show, and then, you know, yeah, the season's over, the series is over, and you get attached to these characters and you want to sort of spend more time with them. So you make up what happened after the show ended, or you talk about what they did in their childhood and come up with stuff that really rounds out a character sometimes in ways that the show writers never expected or probably never would have been creative enough to come up with. So it's always
Couldn't come up with. I mean, they may have floated it, but right, there are certain, you know, constraints mm-hmm. put upon someone.
Yeah, the thing that they can't confidently sell, I guess, or that they're not willing to risk their budgets right. with.
And I think Jenkins gets into that somewhat about the sort of economic and ratings craving forces behind how a television show takes the direction it ends up taking. And it's not just one person's creative effort, the way you have like Song of Ice and Fire or something like that, where you can just get really into this one person and analyze what he's doing. But with television, it's a lot more accessible, I think, to adapting into fan works, because they're forced to do things for certain reasons that excludes maybe what you where the point of view that you're coming from. And so you can just be like, well, they don't want to do this because of this, but I can do that. Whereas you get, I think you yeah. get more, I mean, you do get a lot of, obviously, Song of Ice and Fire type fan fiction too, but he also has a nice big world to play in. But yes. there are more people that are, I guess, respect an author's autonomy versus a TV show's author's autonomy. Unless it's Joss Whedon.
That depends.
Yeah, I guess.
I think it's variable. But I do think that makes, that is another good way into some of this stuff that I wanted to mention. I think Mary pointed this out to me in the conclusion, and I'm trying to find where he says it explicitly, that he's talking about like different kinds of fans, because this is very much focused on television programs.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, I mean, there are a lot of television.
Oh, was it that quote that I gave you earlier?
Yes.
I think I have it here. Yeah, he says, I'm not even sure that the types of fans I've discussed here, fans of a particular configuration of popular narratives, are necessarily identical with other varieties of fans of specific media personalities, rock performers, sports teams, or soap operas. I was
this
like,
this is on
well,
page, sorry.
Oh, it's
Mary,
on,
this is
page...
on page 286.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, and I was like, yeah, no, they totally are the same. I mean, they can be the same.
Mm.
Because you see fic for all of those things now.
Right, but I think that's huge. But like RPF is relatively recent as far as an...
I don't think that's actually true.
I don't think so.
I think it's exploded in the last few years that it... Like when I first started getting into fandom in like 2000, you didn't see much of it. I mean, maybe people could have been writing it for sure, but...
Well, what's interesting is, like, with RPF, is that I think RPF is, the thing I find fascinating about it is how it rides the line between fic and gossip. Because, honestly, a lot of RPF fandom is expand from either people with slash goggles watching sort of the interactions of actors, and I think this is what's going on in, like, the SPN, the Supernatural real person slash fan fiction, where you see like Jared and Jensen, J squared as they call it, and their interactions, and you're like, wow, if we watch this with slash goggles, it totally looks like they're married. Or the fact that there's real gossip out there about people's relationships and how it doesn't necessarily fit the established narrative, which is presented in, you know, in Hollywood magazines or the media, because that's what the actors need in order to enhance, sort of advance their careers.
So we have been talking, I know we haven't, this isn't going to be the whole thing, but we've been here for over an hour now, so
yeah.
We want to try and wrap this up somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was hoping that we could talk about, I mean, we've been very favorable towards his
yes,
work.
Yes, that's fair. If we want to be a little more critical.
Yeah, I have a couple of criticisms that I have, two big ones.
Okay.
The first is sort of his understanding of masculine behavior versus feminine behavior.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I will say that I read his blog, and like, he's definitely evolved his viewpoint.
Yes.
Right.
And he hosts discussions on gender and fan culture and a lot of very interesting stuff. Actually, I think he had one that's called Gender and Fan Culture.
Yeah.
Which is very much worth a read. But I do think it's interesting that, you know, Lucconi, I mean, I think in the last episode you introduced Jenkins as the seminal
mm-hmm.
work, and it really is. It really is. And what's funny is that his is a male voice, but he's writing for sort of in defense of a subculture that, in my experience, is remarkably female.
Mm-hmm. It is.
I thought actually that was interesting that in some like, he was discussing different fandoms and different kinds of fan reactions in terms of gender. Like, he was talking about this Twin Peaks BBS, essentially, over the 90s, where, you know, it was mostly male discussion of, you know, theorization about what's going to happen next. And that was, like, their...
It was, like, let's solve the puzzle kind of interaction with the, with the media.
And so he had this very... He did have this very gendered breakdown. And, I mean, I found his text was very... very focused on, like, male versus female, or maybe not even versus, but, like, focusing on male and female differences in a really strong way, in a way that doesn't, you know, for one thing, doesn't leave space for other gender interpretations that may not necessarily be masculine or feminine or male-female.
Well, I mean, like, for me, I mean, I went to an all-women's college, so when I was introduced to fandom in college, like, everything that he talks about in here, I saw among my friends and among other fan at college. And so the idea of, I mean, I remember when Battlestar Galactica came out, all of my friends and I were sitting there going, what is going to happen next?
This, that.
It wasn't actually about the emotions for us. We did not go down the emotional route. We were very much into the world building. I was into, of course, the literary references because... That's how I read. But it was a lot of, like, let's solve the puzzle. And especially for a season, there were a lot of puzzles to be solved in that show. Right. So I that turned me off reading it now. I mean, it didn't turn me off when I read it back in college, because I was kind of reading for acceptance. I was reading for, okay, this is the culture that you're participating in.
Right.
These are the words that you can use to talk about it, which is so powerful. But now I read it and I'm like, wait. So basically what you're telling me is that men care about science and women care about feelings.
Yeah, but he does base some of it in other people's research on the socialization of genders in their own reading and what they're sort of guided towards by society. And so
I found that take on it to be interesting, that, you know, this is how we are taught to consume stuff, and so even though fan culture is more critical, we still have this, you know, cultural baggage that we're bringing to the table with us when we come.
And when you tie it into the feminization of the typical male fan,
right
all of a sudden it makes more sense. And if you think of it as the sort of feminized standpoint as one that is subordinate, but then you look at this behavior as confrontational and challenging the cultural hierarchy, then it starts to make more sense. However, I do think that it becomes almost gender essentialized in certain aspects. And that is, like I said, he's gotten way better.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't have to be that.
But he's only had 20 years, so, you know. I'm interested. I will make a note of this. I think Luconi mentioned it last time, but that he is actually releasing a new, well, not a new version, but this is
new
being
edition.
Re-released for its 20th anniversary with a new introduction, I believe. And so I think it will be interesting for us to, once that comes out in like another month or two, whenever that will be, and whenever we have time to get onto reading it, to do another analysis just to see what all new he has to say.
I'm sure he'll bring the internet into it a whole lot and how things have changed.
Yeah. I hope so, because there's the internet now.
Yeah.
So what was your other criticism then? So we've got the gender issue, which I think we're all pretty much on board with.
Right.
The other criticism I have is actually one of terminology, which seems maybe a little pedantic, but I don't like this terminology of poachers and nomads that he goes into.
Right. Didn't he take that from Deserto?
Yeah, Deserto.
Yeah, he takes it from Deserto. But it's very...
it's othering.
It's very othering.
And I mean, this is something he explicitly says he's trying not to do, but at the same time, it does place fans on the outside and as an illegitimate, homeless sort of...
Or appropriate. Yes. Right? Or and wrongly appropriated. Appropriative.
Yeah, it does.
And almost destructive. I mean, nomads not so much, but poachers.
Yeah.
There's a level of, it's just like there's the preserved text and poachers come in and take away from that.
But I think I almost like the poacher imagery in some sense, because I can relate it to issues of like copyright infringement, for instance. Like where you can approach it as like, I'm taking this thing, which they say legally I can't do, and screw them, I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah. And it goes, it, to me, like, if I think about it in modern terms of poaching, like, maybe not. But if I go back to, like, oh, you know, the kind of poaching that got people sent to Van Diemen's Land back in, you know, 17th, 18th century England, where, you know, you have, like, this is, this land belongs to the king, and if you hunt here, you're like, you know, no matter what you need, you know, you're trying to feed your family, whatever, you'll get your lives will be ruined, like that kind of authority.
Mm-hmm. Versus AKA NBC, mm-hmm. CBS, ABC.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Like that kind of interaction. Like I can handle it better if I'm thinking about it in that context, I guess.
There is that, but I'd like to sort of offer a different. Make that I think does cover one sort of shade of fandom.
Right.
Another shade I think is there's a different sort of metaphor that I really like, which is the metaphor of the gleaner. So the gleaner, for those of you who don't know, is when people harvest the fields, right? Gleaners are people generally of lower class who go behind after the harvest and pick up the viable foodstuffs that have fallen off. Maybe they're, or were rejected for not being...
Not commercial, maybe not. You know,
commercial enough, right? And this is a, you know, this is in the Bible. Like, this is as old as agriculture.
And people still and do so, it. I know, I know people who have been gleaners in their lives.
Yeah, and it's, I kind of like it because it's not, you're essentially, if you're gleaning, it doesn't really operate in under the law. Sometimes people tolerate it. Like Joss Whedon, he's very tolerant of fan fiction, mm-hmm. right? And he seems to be very, you know, like, yeah, sure, come play in my sandbox. Here, have some references to Spike and Angel hooking up once. no, that's in.
No,
the text,
I believe you.
Right?
It's still funny.
Yeah, it is. And then you have people like Anne Rice who are like, OMG, get out of my field. You can't be here. I'm going to sue you. So I kind of like this because it's, you know, gleaning is something that's not technically legal, but is tolerated.
Right.
And it kind of like the people who come behind and sort of pick up what's not necessarily being used or developed as much, right? That people, that the producers don't have the time or the inclination to use and develop.
Right.
And that's kind of the metaphor that I like. And there's a new word, or not a new word, but in ACAFAN studies or ACAFAN studies, academic fans. There's a terminology that I think is from Derrida, but I haven't read it because who has time to read Derrida right now? And it's called archonic literature, or no, archontic literature.
Oh.
Has anyone ever heard this before?
I have not. No. Go ahead. No. Inform us.
So, to the best of my understanding, archontic literature or is about literature that adds. So instead of it's what's something that this person Gail Dukosnik talks about archontic literature as literatures of the subordinate. So it's still this idea that it's stories and sort of points of view that may not necessarily be the dominant narrative. But when you work into sort of multiple voices and multiple viewpoints, storytelling becomes much more elastic. And as people tell and retell these stories and they put in their own points of view or they pick up on something that wasn't necessarily developed in the first telling, it doesn't diminish the text.
Right.
It adds to it. And that puts me right back at Homer. I mean, I hate to bring it back to Homeric poetry because...
No, you don't.
No, you don't.
All right. I love bringing it back to Homeric poetry, but I sort of feel like that's going to be a thing with me. But you, like, you read Homeric poetry, and there are places where you can be like, look, in the catalog of ships, there are references to Athenians. There were no Athenians in the Bronze Age, or even in, you know, the Iron Age, really.
Right.
You know, to the point where they had ships. So this was something that was added to the text in... you know, maybe 5th century Athens. And then you have, like, these discussions in the Socratic dialogues of were Achilles and Patroclus hooking up, right? This is something that is written down in the Socratic dialogues. Did this happen? They seriously discussed this. And it becomes part of how we read Homer. And And it's always being worked on. And these things do not take away from the text. They add to it. They enrich it. And I kind of like this archontic literature because it sounds fancy. but it does come with this idea of addition and not detraction, which is what the poaching, to me, I'm like, no, we're not leaving holes.
Right. That's fair. That is a good point.
Cool.
Well, does anybody else have any other criticisms they want to add?
No, I'm good.
Yeah, I think the gender one was the big one for me.
Yeah.
Eris already covered that. So.
Okay. So awesome. That means it's time for recommendations.
Woohoo!
Yay!
All right. So who wants to go first for recommendations? I can if nobody else wants to.
Go, go, go.
Go.
All right. So this is going to be a fun one. I am going to be recommending a piece called Working Title by Francesca. And this is a piece of work. It is, in fact, the seminal piece of work in the Ghost Soup Infidel Blue fandom.
Yay!
Now, let me tell you something about Ghost Soup Infidel Blue, which is that it doesn't actually exist. This was all based on a post that, so this was a story written in Yuletide for Livia Penn, and it's based on a post that Livia made giving people advice on how to write a good letter for the Yuletide exchange, basically to let your potential author know what sorts of things you liked. And in this letter, she included an example of a bad request. And so Francesca read this, and I guess it filtered through her brain for like a year or two. And then she's eventually decided to take that bad request, which I can read to you because it's right in front of me. Luke makes out with Angela's clone, and Angela gets mad and seduces Moira just to make Luke mad. And then Luke and Ryan duel to the death with their lightsabers, and it ends up in an Angela's clone Moira threesome, and Ryan feels really bad and flies off to Mars forever. So that was her example of a bad, you know, too prescriptive story. So Francesca took this, like, couple of sentences and then wrote it as if she had been given this for the exchange, like that was her her story assignment. But not only did she write that story, but she added all of this like sort of meta wank to it, like complaining about the request, complaining that they didn't really match on the right canon, complaining about the character concepts. And from there, it's just sort of become its own thing. Like there is this huge comment chain at the end of the story, which is on Archive of Our Own, you know, with people bickering about differences in perceptions of like the canon, like, no, this version is better. No, you know, Blue Classic, I can't believe that you used this fanon concept, but that's totally not right. And so but there is no canon for this, the basis of this argument. People are just making it up as they go along. And so now people have written more stories in it, and it's sort of just become this huge thing that's completely hilarious. And the story itself, like, is amusing to read, and then with this broader context it just becomes incredibly hilarious. And so that's
a fandom without a text. That's amazing.
It is. It's a fandom without a text. And I think, yeah,
it's crazy.
Luconi suggested that we might want to maybe have a look at it at some point, because I think it has a lot of interesting things to say about fan culture, like in the way that people interact with it.
Yeah. We can do a critical reading.
Yes. Yeah. So I think that would be interesting potential topic for a future. But somebody else, go ahead.
I can go.
Sure.
Okay, so mine's not nearly as exciting or hilarious. This is an old, again, I'm going old school, a Gundam Wing fic called Winterlong, and it's pretty much my favorite Gundam Wing fic. And I always try to make everybody read it. And so I'm going to make you guys read it, or, you know,
Yay!
Strongly urge you guys to read it. It's very short. It's only 1,300 words or thereabouts. And it's finally available on AO3. The Ooh. Author is Torch. And
Torch! I love her stuff.
Oh, cool. And it's just a very gentle story about Hiro Yui, who's one of the pilots of the five pilots. Probably the least socially acclimated, and it's he has a different visitor to his house like every couple of months, starting in November, and then it ends in April. And then finally in April, the last person to visit is actually his lover, who's been away for this whole time, but you don't really know that. So the way she reveals details about his life and sort of makes him seem lonely without really explicitly saying that he is, and how he interacts with his friends, and how they, you kind of see that they're kind of stopping by to cheer him up here and there because he's by himself. But again, she doesn't explicitly state this. It just sort of paints a kind of tableau that's just builds slowly and is very understated. And I think it's wonderful if you like the understated and not the over the top. So that's my recommendation. Next.
I can go next.
Okay.
So the story I'm recommending is called The End and the Way. It's by Luzula, and it's in the Left Hand of Darkness fandom.
Oh, cool.
Which is such a tiny fandom, but I find that it gets really, really high quality fics. I think maybe the people who are brave enough to take it on tend to really like go for it wholeheartedly. And it's a really world-building, you know, it doesn't have any of the canon characters in any of the major roles. And it's exploring, if you haven't read it, The Left Hand of Darkness, the alien culture that is explored in that don't have genders. And so this is, or at least they don't have them most of the time. but this is the story of someone who does, who is a pervert by their definition, who always has a gender and always has sexual interest, or, you know, potential sexual interest. But it's not really about the sex side of things. It's about her life. It's a coming of age story. It's sort of about her learning to accept herself and just, you know, sort of how she functions in this society where she is so different from everybody else that she knows. And so I really like it, and it's on AO3.
Awesome.
Cool. All right.
It's down to you.
Down to me. All right, so the fic that I'm going to rec is actually a fic that I like to rec to people who are new to fandoms or new to fan fiction in general, because it's a very good fanfic, but it doesn't strain credulity in the way that you know, giving somebody, like, I don't know, immediately being like, and Sam and Dean are brothers, but they're having sex. it's a pretty big hurdle. Like, you have to work yourself up to it.
Yes.
So the fic is called Phoenix Burning, and it's by Yahtzee, and it is up on AO3. And it's actually a Buffy fic. It's a Buffy Angel fic. So it's not, the focus isn't the relationship, although the relationship plays an important part. And it goes into what I sort of the genre of fic that I like, the extending the series. So sort of to spoil people, because I think I have to spoil people for certain aspects, which is that at the end of season 5 in Buffy, she dies, and she dies saving the world. And of course, at the beginning of season 6, they bring her back, because otherwise the show would be called The Vampire Slayer.
Right.
And that's, everyone wants to go to Buffy. But this fic postulates that the series ends with 5. That's the end of Buffy. Except that something like 300 years in the future, the Watchers Council calls back, like brings back to life, 5 slayers. The 5 greatest slayers. And in order to fight the vampire infestation that's taken over the world, essentially. And Buffy is one of them. And it's a fantastic, it's extremely well written. I, you know, everyone who talks about how well Yahtzee incorporates the language that Joss Whedon uses and how Buffy uses her specific voice in order to impart strength. I mean, because one of Buffy's strengths is that one of the sort of characteristics of Buffy is how she's always like quipping and saying funny things to vampires. And this narrative uses that. And it starts out Buffy at a very low place. I mean, she wakes up 300 years in the future and everyone she knows is dead. And she really can't handle it. And she starts out at a really low place. And as she begins to build in confidence, build in understanding, she really sort of like gets back into top form. And part of that is the language that she uses. And it's really interesting, especially because it picks up on a lot of the sort of like anti-patriarchal, you know, anti-Watchers Council themes that especially season 7 of Buffy dealt with I'm sorry, but Phoenix Burning, it's awesome. It's kind of it's weird that I'm wrecking it because it's a headfic in a fandom that I didn't really play a lot in, but it is a fantastic fic, and it is on AO3. Phoenix Burning by Yahtzee.
Is it a fantastic fic?
It is. It's fantastic.
Okay, I had to make the bad pun.
All right, so I guess that's the end of our epically long episode 2.
Woohoo!
Yay! So thanks everyone for joining us. Thank you for listening, if you indeed made it this far. And come find us on LiveJournal and or DreamWidth, where we do have accounts under Ficthropology, and you can find links to all our recommendations. So thanks again, and we hope to be back with you in a month.